We're gathered this morning for hearing in the case of Harvey versus the Commonwealth. We're ready when you are, Ms. Mushigan.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Suzanne Mushigan. I was court appointed to represent the appellant, Mr. Harvey. I would ask the court kindly to allow me to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
5 minutes, yes, ma'am.
If I may, obviously we are dealing with a standard of review that deals with both deference to the trial court for factual findings as well as a de novo standard for the constitutional argument.
Well, in that vein, Ms. Mushigan, let me ask you this question. Assuming, for the purposes of my question, that the factual finding of the trial court is supported by the record to the effect that, I know you were not trial counsel, but the trial counsel, in effect, agreed to two separate things. First of all, as to the trial date, and secondly, that trial date was within the speedy trial time frame. If that's the case, then tell us, if you can, why the invited error doctrine or the doctrine of approbating and reprobating would not apply to that situation.
Yes. So we have a unique fact pattern here in that Judge Carson, I would respectfully submit, made a factual finding about what trial counsel was agreeing to in the order preserved on April 24th. Then we have a separate June 9th Judge Weckstein making a different determination factually about what she was agreeing to.
But don't we have essentially a concession at the June 9th hearing? Judge Weckstein, I think it's page 200 and 203 of the appendix, specifically asked, it sounds like you were saying yes to everything. She says yes. And then later on, he specifically says, what I seem to hear is that Mr. McNeil says we have agreed on the date of June 12th, and you say yes. And we have agreed that it is within the speedy trial period, and you say that's this. Is that what you hear? And she responds that is what I hear, and then goes on to explain, but it doesn't matter what I actually said.
Well, if I may, Ms. Timmers, and I sort of detailed exactly in that hearing, page 201, Ms. Timmers explains, we set a date agreeable to my calendar. So, again, she clarifies, and this is after Judge Weckstein on page 203, 204, cites directly to Judge Carson's order. On page 205, Ms. Timmers explains that Mr. McNeil was interrupting me while I was talking. I was trying to resume my bail hearing with Judge Carson.
Well, let me interrupt you. With all due respect, that's a factual argument, it seems to me. And my original question, I'm not sure you've answered yet, but in light of what Judge Russell just asked you, maybe you can answer it now. Assume, again, for the purpose of my question, that we accept Judge Weckstein's version of the facts. Where does that leave you with respect to the invited error doctrine or the doctrine of approbating and reprobating?
And my position is that Judge Weckstein was plainly wrong. This is a unique situation where he is not making a factual determination of what comes before him on June 9th. He is interpreting an isolated portion of an audio tape. I appreciate that's Judge Weckstein's ruling, but again, I would go full circle back to the fact that Judge Carson preserved defense counsel's position on April 24th at the conclusion of that hearing.
Given the fact that Judge Weckstein was simply listening to a tape, I guess it was, but was not present when the discussion occurred, why wouldn't we be in at least the same position to evaluate the meaning of that conversation?
And my position would be that this court can base it on Judge Carson's determination and his rulings in his April 24th hearing. He was the trial court that I'll put it in quotations, evidence was presented. He was the judge to rule on what Ms. Timbers meant, said by her intonation, her responses, exactly what happened.
But is there, it seems to me there's still not anything inconsistent with his order and Judge Weckstein's order if you view availability for a trial date being one thing and whether it falls within a speedy trial to be another. Because even assuming that we all agree that a continuance is within a speedy trial under 19.2.243 subsection 4, I mean, let's say the first trial date is set for 30 days after indictment. And everybody comes in the Commonwealth wants a continuance. Defense counsel would object on speedy trial basis even if everybody agreed that the next trial would be 60 days after indictment because you want the clock to count.
Yes, sir.
And if you don't object, the clock won't count. So is there anything inconsistent with objecting on speedy trial grounds and agreeing that it's within speedy trial? It doesn't seem to me that there is. Or at least not necessarily.
And I may not be gathering exactly what you're inquiring, Judge. The problem that I have is that the defense counsel's suggestion that she is available for a court date is not an affirmative, I'm choosing that court date.
That's Baker, but if we assume the next thing, that there was an additional affirmative response, that is not, I'm simply available, that it is within speedy trial. That's not inconsistent with also asserting a speedy trial objection, because you want the time to count, because there may be another continuance, and you would want that time to count. And if you don't make the speedy trial objection, it would be told, right?
Yes, sir.
There was no fact-finding by the trial court, though, that there was an agreement that this new date was within the speedy trial date.
Right? No, sir. And that is precisely my point, that in Judge Carson's ruling on his April 24th, at the conclusion of that hearing, the only finding of fact, in my opinion, I'll submit, is that he said defense counsel under no circumstances is waiving speedy trial. And I think in the this court's opinion, it was discussed for the fact that had Judge Carson said by Ms. Timmers, acknowledging by her yes, that she was in fact now waiving that, Judge Carson could have included that in his order. But he didn't speak to that. What he decided at the conclusion of both those hearings was that she had properly preserved it, and under no circumstances was she waiving that.
But even the finding by Judge Weckstein on the next day, I guess it was, did not include a finding that there had been an agreement that the new date was within the speedy trial period.
I will say this. It is very difficult to read Ms. Timmer's sort of interaction with the courts. She is just adamant in that hearing, I believe on June 9th, in front of Judge Weckstein, that he was taking out of context the blip of the recording, and that what she had done procedurally for any defense attorney is not only object on April 23rd, object again on April 24th, that was immediately placed on the record. The judge noted, I will include it in the order, and it was included in the order.
But is there anything inconsistent with asserting a speedy trial objection and agreeing that the new date is within speedy trial? It seems to me those things are not mutually exclusive.
And I would agree with that under the Baker case. I think that the Dufresne case has suggested, at least with an invited error, that somehow Ms. Timmers, by yes, and at least I would submit is telling the Commonwealth attorney to shush, I'm in the middle of my bail hearing, that somehow because she has suggested that this June 12th court date...
Ms. Michigan, you know, she can't really sort of check out at that point and talk only about bond, can she? Because when they're talking about bond, but then they go back to the June 12th date, and it's mentioned three times on pages 148 and 149 of the appendix by the Commonwealth that we've both done the math, and it's within the statutory speedy trial limit. It's said a second time at the top of 149, and then finally Mr. McNeil says, we are in agreement, it is within the statutory time frame. And the court says, okay, Ms. Timbers, back to you. And she just wants to talk about bond. She says, so the Commonwealth decided in the order that we can have bond. At that point, if she has, it's been stated to the court, we've both done the computations, it's within speedy trial, doesn't she have at least some obligation to say, well, Your Honor, you know, I can be there on June 12th, but I don't know whether it's in speedy trial or not, or something to alert the court that she has not made that computation.
And respectfully, I would say that the very next sentence out of Ms. Timmer's mouth is relevant, and it doesn't happen in a vacuum. So the Commonwealth decided in the order that we can have a bond. My position, and I argued it in my brief, and I appreciate that perhaps the audio DVD wasn't supplied to this court, but if you listen, what's happening is that they are talking simultaneously. The Commonwealth attorney is now talking about a potential continuance.
That's the very problem, because, you know, hypothetically, it's conceivable to me, at least having done this for quite a while myself before I went on the bench, that the trial counsel was under the impression that, from the transcript, that the Commonwealth was not going to oppose a bond, which would have changed, if that had been granted, that would have certainly changed the speedy trial time frame from 5 months to 9 months, and then the statements would have been correct. The problem is, that's speculation. It would be supported by the record had the fact finder, in this case Judge Weckstein or even Judge Carson, found that to be the case. I guess it would be Judge Weckstein, since this wasn't argued, the bond issue wasn't argued the day before. But I guess my question really would come down to a simple, is a concession that this date is within the five-month speedy trial time frame a concession of fact or a concession of law?
And my suggestion would be, if we agree with Judge Weckstein, it was a question of fact that Judge Weckstein was interpreting the facts from the April 23rd.
If it would seem to me that a discussion about who's attributable to the delay,
yes, sir,
would be a discussion of fact. Did the defense attorney agree to this continuance or request this continuance? But there was no discussion as to the delays involved in this case or who that should be charged against. The only discussion was the ultimate question of, is this within speedy trial, which would be a legal issue.
Yes, sir. I agree. It is somewhat of a blended issue depending on sort of which part of the argument you start looking
and
at.
Doesn't all of this discussion about what the defense attorney said or didn't say kind of put the cart before the horse, because the defense attorney has no obligation whatsoever to alert the court whether speedy trial has been violated or not. The obligation is on the Commonwealth to bring the defendant to trial within that period of time.
Yes, and interesting enough, the Commonwealth attorney in the argument before Judge Weckstein completely shifts the burden to the defense to say, you should have made a point of bringing up the court date earlier than June 9th if you'd known that that's what you had agreed to.
And getting back to Judge Petty's original question, if this is indeed a question of law, wouldn't we as a court be in a position to interpret what Judge Carson said as opposed to what Judge Weckstein said?
I absolutely think that's what it is, Your Honor. I think that's exactly what Judge Carson did in his April 24th order, and then what Judge Weckstein was interpreting Judge Carson. But I believe you all can look at what Judge Carson ruled and make that as both the statutory and, again, in my opinion, a factual finding that it was not waived. And
why can't we look at Judge Carson's April 24th order that you quite rightly rely on as essentially saying, you asked me to note that you're not waiving speedy trial. And the reason, of course, she doesn't want to waive speedy trial, as has been alluded to, she wants the clock to keep ticking. She doesn't want it told. But that you have at least acknowledged that this date, not only can you be there, but you've acknowledged that this date is within statutory speedy trial, whether you're right or not.
I don't believe that Judge Carson made that finding at all. I think it's...
But you can't read it within the overall record, the whole record, as being he's setting it because it's been acknowledged that it's within. That one date is within.
If you read the entire record, page 122, which was provided as part of their briefs for this motion to dismiss indictment, Judge Carson makes it very clear, there did not appear to be a meeting of minds. It was my thought that any and all further proceedings of this matter needs to be on the record. He goes on to say, again, all I need is a couple of days, that's the Commonwealth attorney, a couple of days to get this witness. At the conclusion of that, what Judge Carson makes a finding of is that she's not waiving speedy trial, and that everything should be preserved on the record, and not about the, conversations that defense counsel and Commonwealth attorney may have had outside of the courtroom. He makes a point of saying there is no meeting of the minds between the Commonwealth and defense attorney.
Let me point out to you that you got a late signal, but you're in your rebuttal time.
Yes, and I will step back. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Campbell?
Mr. Campbell, is there any question or doubt that this trial occurred beyond the five-month limit of the speedy trial statute?
No, Your Honor. Let me introduce myself. May it please the Court, Aaron Campbell.
Yeah, sure enough. Thank
you.
Well,
okay. Just for the record, I think you could, no.
Nobody's actually done the math to determine if this actually works out to be a speedy trial.
It is beyond 152 days and a fraction days.
And, of course, there's no question that the Commonwealth's attorney did not know that. Would that be a fair statement? Or at least did not bring it to the attention of the trial court?
Yeah, that is correct.
Given that we no longer have the benefit of the reasoning of Dufresne, aren't we governed by the Baker case?
No, we are not governed by the Baker case. I think a ruling in this case would not overrule Baker.
Well, you agree that Baker stands for the proposition that defense counsel can stand mute. The question here is that all that happened?
That is not all that's happened, and I agree with that assessment of Baker. What the problem with this case is that defense counsel took that extra step and acquiesced and agreed that this trial date was within the speedy trial.
Counsel, I've gone to the record, and I've counted at least 9 different times where defense counsel at the trial level advanced her client's rights under speedy trial, and there's an order specifically saying that speedy trial is not waived. Are we just to ignore that?
I think we're not ignoring that. We are looking at the trial court, which is the City of Roanoke trial court, interpretation of that order. And what the trial court in this case determined was that the defense counsel approbated and reprobated.
Well, the problem with that is that we, to follow up on Judge Alston's question, it seems to me you're suggesting that I didn't do the count he did, but I'll accept his number, 9 times advancing her client's speedy trial rights, preserving them in an order, and then in a one-word answer the next day in a convoluted conversation has waived everything that she did 24 hours earlier at some effort. So, well, I mean, that's certainly the conclusion the trial court drew, but, you know, is that... You know, is that where we are? Is that your position that one-word answer basically undercuts everything that was done without any further analysis?
No, Your Honor. It's beyond the one-word answer. Certainly there was the yeses that the Commonwealth said, we've done the math, and this is within the time frame, and the defense counsel said yes to both of those things. But we also have the Commonwealth saying 3 times at that hearing, as Judge Beals pointed out, that we have confirmed that and agreed to this trial date and picked it because it is agreeable to the defense's calendar and that it is within the statutory time frame. And the defense counsel never corrected that. And as much like...
Is there an obligation to correct it on the part of the defense counsel, given Baker?
I think so. I think what the Commonwealth is representing is that we have come to this agreement. The defense counsel agrees and has taken the position that this is fine for speedy trial purposes.
But that would be a waiver. That would be a joining in on the motion, the continuance, or a waiver of the speedy trial rights. And that clearly didn't happen here. Isn't that fair?
I think it is a waiver because what the defense counsel is doing is they are agreeing that there is no problem with this new trial date.
But the motion, there was a motion to continue that was made by the Commonwealth, correct?
Absolutely.
Is it your position that the defense counsel somehow joined in that motion for continuance?
No, there was an objection. And I agree. And under Baker, if the defense counsel had said nothing and said, and the Commonwealth said, we have picked this new trial date, and the defense counsel had said nothing, then...
So is the Commonwealth's position this was essentially an applied waiver? That seems to be what the trial court concluded. Is that your position?
I believe so.
And it was a waiver without joining in the motion for continuance.
Let me see if I can explain this a little better.
Well, wait a minute. Let me follow up on my question, because if you're relying on a waiver theory, how do you square that with Norton, our decision in Norton, which says the record must indicate that any waiver of speedy trial was knowing, intelligent, and voluntary, and if it fails to do so, no waiver may be implied. How do we infer a knowing, intelligent, and voluntary waiver from multiple yeses in this context? If that's the Commonwealth's theory,
I think that is a factual determination that the trial judge made, and based on listening to the audio, listening to the record, and you have to do the evidence in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, and I don't think that is plainly wrong for the trial court.
Can I ask you on that? When Judge Weckstein is interpreting what the court did, and he is part of the court, it is the court, not just Judge Weckstein and Judge Carson, right? So, but when he's interpreting Judge Carson's order, we owe him considerable deference, right? But when he's looking at the record, which we can do as well, although he had the audio tape and we don't, how much deference do we owe him in looking at the rest of the record?
I think you have to entitle him deference because he's also seen trial courts, trial counsel's responses in determining based on what the trial counsel said that she meant by that. I think the court owes deference to the trial court in this situation. And I'd also point out that
That was essentially what you're saying. I don't mean to cut you off, but I am. Essentially, you're saying that the trial court is, with regard to the lawyer, making a credibility determination?
Yes, there is a credibility determination, I think, in that. Or if it's credibility determination or...
regarding whether counsel said yes in response to the statement, and it is within, we agree it is within speedy trial, in the hearing in front of Judge Weckstein, she concedes on two different occasions that, yes, that's what she said. It's whether it has moment or effect is the argument. I mean, he says, this is what I hear. Is it what you hear? And she says, yes, that is what I hear. Correct?
Correct.
Now, the interesting question about the case is the same argument, which is the April 24th argument, is transcribed two separate times. It's transcribed the first time in the normal course, but then when it's, of course, played again and considered by the trial court on June 9th, it's transcribed a second time. Those transcriptions don't match.
In what respect?
The order of the yeses. One of them has a yes after you agree that it's within speedy trial, and one of them does not, suggesting, I think Ms. Michigan has fairly characterized it as everybody was talking over everybody. Do we resolve that conflict, or does the trial court, when the matter is still within the breast of the trial court?
I would say the trial court, but I'd also point out that multiple times the Commonwealth said that we agree on this trial date because there was no speedy trial problem. And I'd also point out that at the June hearing, counsel confirmed that she was agreeing to the trial date because she picked it because it was agreeable to her calendar and because of the trial of the Commonwealth speedy trial concerns.
You suggest that the defense attorney in this case at trial counsel had some obligation to clarify the matter for the trial court. Didn't the prosecutor have an equal obligation, it seems to me, if we're going to go down that road, to basically make clear to Judge Weckstein that this selection of this particular trial date, in effect, was a waiver of what had occurred 24 hours earlier in front of Judge Carson? I thought you were suggesting that there was some confusion here. The obligation was on the part of trial counsel to clarify, you know, what she was objecting to and what she wasn't objecting to. And it seems to me that shoe fits the other foot too. And the prosecutor might have had some obligation to clarify in front of Judge Weckstein, who wasn't present the day before, that this was in fact a clear waiver of any speedy trial issue.
I think I'm confused by her statement the day before. We're talking, this is weeks before.
Weeks before, I'm sorry. Judge Carson said.
I mean, certainly the Commonwealth, in their opening remarks, said we had the next day, we had a meeting, and we picked this trial date. In fact, the defense counsel actually did the computations, and agreed that this was in the statutory speedy trial date.
Mr. Campbell,
was trying to clear that up.
I don't go back to what I thought was a fairly well-reasoned opinion in Dufresne. Apparently it wasn't. But when we were looking at that case, we were discussing, I know, that with the litigants, the issue of the concept, legal concept you mentioned, approbate and reprobate. And I seem to recall at the time that I was fairly well convinced that that legal concept had no meaning or no application at the trial level. All the cases that I saw were cases where there was an inconsistent position taken at trial versus on appeal. Here the trial court has applied that to inconsistent positions taken at trial, and I think that was your argument earlier when you mentioned it. Are you aware of any cases that would support the application of approbate, reprobate to inconsistent positions taken only at trial?
I I think what you're saying is that, isn't that fundamentally what affidavit reprobate is? Is that isn't even...
Well, all the cases, the inconsistencies occur between a position taken at trial and a position taken on appeal. Here, we're simply talking about two positions taken at trial. And I can't find any cases that apply that doctrine to trial court arguments.
Okay, I think I understand what you're saying. I don't know right off the bat, Your Honor.
Assuming that there is. Assuming
the
now non-existent opinion in Dufresne cites such a case, would that support your position?
Yes, in our position, the rule that we are trying, or this is the simple rule that we are trying to put forth to the court. If a defendant represents that there is no speedy trial issue with the new trial date, they cannot later argue that there is. That is approbate reprobate. It is not an abuse of discretion for the trial court to hold that defendant to their original position if there was no speedy trial issue.
Mr. Campbell, in the context of this case, and I think one thing that everyone can agree on is that the record is cloudy as to what's going on and who's saying what and when. But would you agree that the discussion of the speedy trial as it relates to what we need to decide here actually arose in the context of the bond motion? The bond motion and the speedy trial sort of were subsumed within each other. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
And would you also agree, and I think you know the answer to this pretty easily, is that the speedy trial calculation is different when you're talking about a person being on bond and not on bond?
Yes. So and that is important in this case.
So if defense counsel, assuming for the sake of discussion, the defense counsel is working from the perspective that we're talking about a bond motion now, and so therefore the 152 days and a fraction calculation doesn't apply, the nine-month calculation applies, isn't it conceivable that her response is consistent with what Ms. Machigan said, was related to the fact that she thought she was going to get a bond for her client and was thereby agreeing that I'll set it on this date, assuming that that is the case, and then when she found out that that was not indeed the case, said, wait a minute, I am not waiving speedy trial, and I want the order to reflect that.
Certainly afterwards, on page 175 of the appendix, the Commonwealth said, we have agreed that this has posed no speedy trial problem, this new trial date, and the defense counsel had an opportunity to correct that and never did.
But if a nine-month period was to apply, and that was the context, they'd already the Commonwealth wanted a continuance, and so now they're going into a period after the speedy trial, after the objection has been documented in a court order. Doesn't it stand that there was no waiver? The defense counsel was simply working in the context of a nine-month period instead of a five-month period.
Maybe I can be clear. I'm not saying that the waiver is an inconsistent position. This defendant is taking an inconsistent position. There is a representation, whether it's an acquiesce or whether it's an affirmative, that this was fine for speedy trial purposes. And then, weeks down the road, it's like, no, we're changing our position. This actually is a speedy trial problem. The court should dismiss. And the court said, I'm going to hold you to that original position based on the record that I have reviewed with counsel and based on counsel's statements at this speedy trial hearing.
Mr. Campbell, in this case, and we've all gone through it, and we've looked at the various case law out there, most of the situations that we have for invited error, approbate, reprobate, actually deal with gradation of offense. I think that's a fair way of saying it. You know, I think I'm going to be pleading guilty to petty larceny. I want to withdraw that. I don't want to plead guilty to that because everyone's agreed that it should be reduced. In other words, we're talking about gradation of offense. Are you aware of any cases where we're talking about approbate and reprobate in the context of statutory interpretation?
No, Your Honor.
Let me ask one hypothetical question. If prosecutor says, Your Honor, here's a date I propose. I've done the calculations. It's within the speedy trial date. And defense counsel says, well, I haven't done the math, but I'm willing to accept counsel's representation to that effect. Do we have an approbate and reprobate situation if it turns out that the prosecutor can't count properly?
I think it is onus.
Is that acquiescence?
I think it is an acquiescence. And I think this is, if I could, I'm going to answer.
Please do, yes.
Approbate and reprobate, above all, is concerned with fairness. And that if the defendant is agreeing that this is fine for speedy trial purposes, whether it's a mistake or not, they should be on their toes. I think that's entirely fair for all the litigants. If they just say, I don't know if that's good for speedy trial purposes, then no, we wouldn't win.
And if I could follow up on Judge Humphrey's question, assuming that counsel accepted the Commonwealth's calculation that it was within speedy trial, and then after he or she went back to the office, calculated it himself or herself, and put a motion back on before the court saying, Judge, when the Commonwealth said that they were incorrect, I'm coming back in now and I'm saying this is not within speedy trial, would that be considered a waiver?
That would not be considered a waiver. I think what the court could take into consideration is that the defendant has now determined that this was incorrect, and they can, in their discretion, determine that this was not a waiver. But I do think it is a waiver, or is certainly within the trial court's discretion to hold the defendant to the earlier position when, at the last minute, they come after a speedy trial is run and say, I've changed my position. With that, I'd ask the court to affirm.
Thank you. Ms. Moshigan?
Piggybacking on the last questions from the court, it is an alarming proposition for defense counsel to make an objection and then be in a position to tell the trial court, I can't agree to a date. I can't nod my head in agreement. I can't say I think the Commonwealth attorney has done the math correct.
Well, that's not what we have here. This isn't a question of whether he's agreeing to the date. This is a question of whether the defense counsel affirmatively said that date is okay as far as speedy trial is concerned. Those are two different questions.
And with respect, I think the interpretation from Judge Weckstein is an interpretation that by her yes retorts, she is now agreeing that it falls within the statutory speedy trial.
Is that factual or is that a legal determination?
I think it's his factual determination of what her statements mean.
Do you agree that it would be helpful for us to have the audio tape?
I believe I wish in hindsight you all had been supplied that.
And whose burden is that to have prepared that for the purpose of the appellate court?
It should have been included in the appendix, and that falls on me. Unfortunately, we have multiple transcripts from there. I was afforded the opportunity to hear that, so to the best
but
I can...
But it is in the record, is it not?
It is in the record. It
and
was
then,
not
of course, we're not limited to the appendix. We can look to the record if necessary.
And I would love for you all to listen to that. I think it becomes clear...
It is still in existence, then.
It should be in the record, yes, sir.
It's not either.
We haven't been able to obtain it.
But to finish that, yes,
well,
sir.
Assuming that we accept Judge Weckstein's fact-finding on the record that we do have, would you agree that if it was actual agreement that the date is within speedy trial, that's different in kind than Baker? Baker says you could agree to the date
just remain quiet.
And stand mute. If you accept Weckstein's finding, she didn't just stand mute.
I make a distinction because she's not making an affirmative remark. In Dufresne and others where they talk about counsel inviting error, they are moving the court to do something. They are asking the court to do something. Find this as a lesser included, do this, now I'm going to argue that was error. What Ms. Timmers is agreeing, yes, 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 is to a statement or to a position taken by the Commonwealth attorney, none of which is supported in the written record.
If the parties have a stipulation or an agreement that hasn't been reduced to writing, I mean, how else would one put it on the record but have one half of the lawyers recite what the agreement is and the other one say something to the effect of yes or that's correct?
Well, in every stipulation I've had, we present as defense counsel, that is the stipulation, Your Honor, and we're in agreement. A yes retort subject to interpretation is not the same thing as affirmatively saying, I am absolutely agreement putting forward as defense counsel for the position of my client that despite my last 2 days of arguments, I am now waiving and agreeing that June 12th is an appropriate day that states within the 5-month statutory speedy trial. Again, there's still a question mark in the middle of her bond hearing where she asks, are you agreeing to bond? And then we would have been looking at the 9-month. And then if Ms. Timmer's statements can be interpreted, I'll absolutely agree if we put him out on bond. So I present all that to the court. Thank you.
Very well. Thank you very much. The matter has been submitted. You'll hear from us shortly. That concludes the hearing.
All right.